Chapter 56. The U.S. Navy salvage tugs Thomas J. Morse and Samuel R. Wallace arrived just before 1500 hours and slowly began circling the Titanic. The vast size and the strange death-like aura of the derelict filled the tug's crews with the same feeling of awe that was experienced by the Numa salvage people the day before. After a half hour of visual inspection, the tugs pulled parallel to the great rusty hull and lay to in the heavy swells, their engines on stop. Then, as if in unison, their cutters were lowered, and the captains came across and began climbing a hastily thrown boarding ladder to the Titanic shelter deck. Lieutenant George Uphill of the Morse was a short, plump, ruddy-faced man who sported an immense Bismarck mustache, while Lieutenant Commander Scotty Butera of the Wallace nearly scraped the ceiling at 6 feet 6 and buried his chin in a magnificent black beard. No spick-and-span fleet officers, these two. They looked and acted every bit the part of tough, no-nonsense salvage men. "You don't know how happy we are to see you, gentlemen," Gunn said, shaking their hands. "Admiral Sandecker and Mr. Dirk Pitt, our special projects director, are awaiting you in, if you'll pardon the expression, our operations room." The tug captains tailed after Gunn up the stairways and across the boat deck, staring in trance-like rapture at the remains of the once beautiful ship. They reached the gymnasium and Gunn made the introductions. "It's positively incredible," Uphill murmured. "I never thought in my wildest imagination that I would ever live to walk the decks of the Titanic." "My sentiments exactly," Butera added. "I wish we could give you a guided tour," Pitt said, "but each minute adds to the risk of losing her to the sea again." Admiral Sandecker motioned them to a long table laden with weather maps, diagrams, and charts, and they all settled in with steaming mugs of coffee.
"Our chief concern at the moment is weather," he said. "Our weatherman on board the Capricorn has suddenly taken to imagining himself as the prophet of doom."
Pitt unrolled a large weather map and flattened it on the table. "There's no ducking the bad news. Our weather is deteriorating rapidly. The barometer has fallen half an inch in the last 24 hours. Wind, force 4, blowing north-northeast and building. We're in for it, gentlemen, make no mistake. Unless a miracle occurs and Hurricane Amanda decides to cut a quick left turn to the west, we should be well into her front quadrant by this time tomorrow."
"Hurricane Amanda," Butera repeated the name. "How nasty is she?"
"Joel Farquhar, our weatherman, assures me they don't come any meaner than this baby," Pitt replied. "She's already reported winds of force 15 on the Beaufort scale."
"Force 15?" Gunn repeated in astonishment. "My God, force 12 is considered a maximum hurricane."
"This, I'm afraid," said Sandecker, "is every salvage man's nightmare come true. Raise a derelict only to have it snatched away by a whim of the weather."
He looked grimly at Uphill and Butera.
"It looks as though you two made the trip for nothing. You'd better get back to your ships and make a run for it."
"Make a run for it, hell," Uphill boomed. "We just got here."
"I couldn't have said it better."
Butera grinned and looked up at Sandecker.
"The Morse and the Wallace can tow an aircraft carrier through a swamp in a tornado if they have to. They're designed to slug it out with anything Mother Nature can dish out. If we can get a cable on board the Titanic and get her under tow, she'll stand a fighting chance of riding out the storm intact."
"Pulling a 45,000-ton ship through the jaws of a hurricane," Sandecker murmured. "That's a pretty heady boast."
"No boast," Butera came back dead serious.
"By fastening a cable from the stern of the Morse to the bow of the Wallace, our combined power can tow the Titanic in the same manner as a pair of railroad engines in tandem can pull a freight train. And we can do it in 30-foot seas at a speed of 5 to 6 knots, Uphill added.
Sandecker looked at the two tug captains and let them go on. Butera charged ahead.
"Those aren't run-of-the-mill harbor tugs floating out there, Admiral. They're deep-sea ocean rescue tugs. 250 feet in length with 5,000-horse diesel power plants. Each boat capable of hauling 20,000 tons of dead weight at 10 knots for 2,000 miles without running out of fuel. If any two tugs in the world can pull the Titanic through a hurricane, these can.
I appreciate your enthusiasm, Sandecker said, but I won't be responsible for the lives of you and your crews on what has to be an impossible gamble. The Titanic will have to drift out the storm as best she can. I'm ordering you both to shove off and head into a safe area.
Uphill looked at Butera. Tell me, Commander, when was the last time you defied a direct command from an admiral?
Butera feigned mock thoughtfulness.
Come to think of it, not since breakfast.
Speaking for myself and the salvage crew, Pitt said, we'd welcome your company.
There you have it, sir, Butera said, grinning. Besides, my orders from Admiral Kemper were either to bring the Titanic into port or take out papers for an early retirement. Me? I opt for the Titanic.
That's mutiny, Sandecker said flatly. But there was no hiding the trace of satisfaction in his tone, and it took no great stroke of perception to recognize that the argument had gone exactly as he had planned it. He gave everyone a very shrewd look and said,
Okay, gentlemen, it's your funeral. Now that that's settled, I suggest that instead of sitting around here, you get about the business of saving the Titanic.
Captain Ivan Porotkin stood on the port wing bridge of the Mikhail Kurkov and searched the sky with a pair of binoculars. He was a slender man of medium height, with a distinguished face that almost never smiled. He was in his late 50s, but his receding hair showed no sign of gray. A thick turtleneck sweater covered his chest, while his hips and legs were encased in heavy woolen pants and knee boots. Porotkin's first officer touched him on the arm and pointed skyward above the Mikhail Kurkov's huge radar dome. A four-engine patrol bomber appeared out of the northeast and magnified until Porotkin could make out its Russian markings. The aircraft seemed to be crawling scant miles per hour above its stalling speed as it swept overhead. Then suddenly a tiny object ejected from the underbelly, and seconds later a parachute blossomed open and began drifting over the ship's forward mastpeak, its occupant finally dropping into the water about 200 yards off the starboard bow. As the Mikhail Kurkov's small boat put away and dipped over the mountainous wide-spaced waves, Porotkin turned to his first officer.
As soon as he is safely on board, conduct Captain Prevloff to my quarters.
Then he laid the binoculars on the bridge counter and disappeared down a companionway. 20 minutes later, the first officer knocked at the highly polished mahogany door, opened it, and then stood aside to allow a man to pass through. He was thoroughly soaked and dripping salt water in puddles about the deck.
Captain Porotkin.
Captain Prevloff.
They stood there in silence a few moments, both highly trained professionals, and sized each other up. Prevloff had the advantage. He'd studied Porotkin's service history in depth. Porotkin, on the other hand, had only repute and first appearances to form a judgment. He wasn't sure he liked what he saw. Prevloff came off too handsome, too fox-like for Porotkin to grasp a favorable sense of warmth or trust.
We are short on time, Prevloff said. If we could get right down to the purpose of my visit.
Porotkin held up his hand.
First things first. Some hot tea and a change of clothing. Dr. Rogovsky, our chief scientist, is about your height and weight.
The first officer nodded and closed the door.
Now then, Porotkin said. I am certain a man of your rank and importance didn't risk his life parachuting into a running sea merely to observe the atmospheric phenomenon of a hurricane.
Hardly. Personal danger is not my cup of tea.
And speaking of tea, I don't suppose you have anything stronger on board.
Porotkin shook his head. Sorry, Captain. I insist on a dry ship. Not exactly to the crew's liking, I admit, but it does save occasional grief.
Admiral Sloyak said you were a paragon of efficiency.
I do not believe in tempting the fates.
Prevloff unzipped his sodden jumpsuit and let it fall on the floor. I am afraid you are about to make an exception to that rule, Captain. We, you and I,
are about to tempt the fates as they have never been tempted before.